You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 26, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer from the American Prospect, Alex Salmon, will be here to talk about the most expensive ballot proposition in U.S. history. Uber and Lyft's massive expenditure in California to buy all of our labor laws. Meanwhile, White House announces no longer going to fight the pandemic as U.S. hits another day of record infections. Meanwhile, Pence's office is now infected, and Texas and Utah are about to ration ICU beds. The probably exposed Pence will preside over the final Senate vote to confirm extremist Amy Coney Barrett today. 8 days left. Early voting already exceeds 2016 totals. But that may not tell us very much. Post-election, Trump plans to fire heads of FBI, CIA, and the Pentagon. And member of the extremist far-right Boogaloo Boys have been charged with firing on police and inciting violence during the Minneapolis Floyd protests. Chile votes overwhelmingly to rewrite their Pinochet-era constitution. That's a big deal. And stimulus prospects seem all but dead. A Biden win means best case scenario, we won't see COVID relief until February of 2021. And lastly, hopes and prayers, Fox News president and other on-air talent advised to quarantine because of exposure to COVID. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. A pleasure to have you. We are now 8 days out from the, well, what we traditionally call Election Day. And as I mentioned, just in the headlines, as of yesterday, 9 days out, more people had voted early voting than had in the entire election in 2020. Now, obviously, in 2016, obviously there's a pandemic. And so people are far more keyed into the idea of voting early, maybe getting their ballot and dropping it off. However, this is still impressive. And I think on some level, it indicates that people are very keyed in, not only to the idea of voting early because there's a pandemic, but keyed into the idea of polling, of voting. And we won't know this until the end of day on November 3rd, or maybe even after that, in terms of how many people ultimately turned out, if we are seeing big numbers. But if 2018 was any indication, I think it's fairly safe assumption that we're going to see turnouts that are at the very least larger than we saw in 2016. And I would imagine it's quite possible we're going to see that both in the Democrat side and the Republican side. So it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the outcome of the election. But it's a good sign just in general that more people are involving themselves in the electoral process. With that said, today we're going to be talking to Alex Salmon about the single most expensive ballot referendum in the history of the country in terms of expenditures. And I can tell you that it's not even 90 to 1 excuse me, 90 to 10. It's not the gig economy side has outspent the non-change our labor laws for the sake of your profit side more than 9 to 10. I mean, 9 to 1. It is, it's pretty stunning. And we will talk to Alex Salmon about that in just a few moments. I found this pretty amazing. You know, Donald Trump obviously is, well, he's not staying in and protecting people from getting infected from COVID. He's not doing that. But he is sending some missives from the White House. And this one I found to be pretty funny because this is, they lock off a camera. They go and say to the president, we need to shoot a 60-second or, you know, a 90-second message from you that will play online and probably on some of the various cable outlets that will do anything we ask them to do. And we'll put it to music and we'll make it really soaring. Can we write a script for you? No, I don't want to have to read anything. And then they go ahead with that project anyways. I mean, one would imagine they would have done one or two takes of this thing. But here it is, Donald Trump with one of his closing arguments, as opposed to the vice president whose closing argument was, as head of the coronavirus task force, let me show you how I can have everyone around me catch the coronavirus. But here's Donald Trump.
When I first announced I was going to run for president 5 years ago, I had a theme. It was a great theme. It was a theme that obviously worked. But the truth is, I made it work also because we followed that theme. Make America great again. Sounds simple, but isn't it beautiful? And that's what we've done. And then we got hit with the plague. We closed it up. We saved millions of lives. And now we've opened it up and we have a super V. Our economy is recovering faster than any economy in the world. And we went down proportionately less than any economy in the world. But we have another thing that we did that a lot of people don't quite understand, but they know something big happened. And the something big was America first. We put America first for the first time in decades and decades. America first. And I tell leaders of other countries, you should put your country first. When they hear America first, it doesn't sound nice. But you know what? I tell them, I'm putting America first. You should put your country first, whatever the country may be.
Dramatic music.
But for us,
over whatever the country may be.
And it always will be. Go to the voting booth and vote early and in person. Don't let them take your vote away. The most important election we've ever had. Thank you.
Did you hear the music swell over the underneath him saying, I've told other countries to put your country first? That's a very big dramatic selling point at that point for the American public.
I like the closed captions best, I think.
That is pretty good. That's impressive. They were like, we could actually do this. We just don't need to use any punctuation. It's very, there is a sense of like, you know, nobody's driving that ship with the campaign. Of course, there's also a sense that there's nobody driving the ship in terms of the administration either at this point. They were doing their best to hide the fact that Mike Pence's chief of staff and others have been infected with COVID. Do we have a running tally of how many people have been infected in that office now? Is it 4? And this is, they're hiding how many people have been infected in that office because, well, one of the things that would shake the faith of people in something like the coronavirus task force and the administration's handling it is if the point person of the entire operation could not even protect the people who work in his office from getting it. We'll play more clips. Well, maybe we should play this anyways. Let's play this. They have essentially said that we're no longer in the business of trying to contain the pandemic because they have utterly failed at it. we are heading into, you know, we have a situation in Utah right now where they're already starting to plan how they're going to ration ICU beds. And make no mistake about it, if they have to move into a situation where they have to ration ICU beds, what they're saying is we're going to decide that some of the people we are caring for, we're going to have to give up on treating them. We're going to have people die. This is when we heard about death panels during the ACA fight. This is literally a death panel, but there is no, this is just simply, you have limited resources. There has been a failed, if no attempt, to contain the number of infections. At one point, it's inevitable. It bleeds, the infections bleed into more vulnerable populations, or frankly, people who just are not necessarily vulnerable on paper, but get COVID, and we don't know exactly why young, healthy people will end up in the ICU, but it happens. And then your ICU beds, because of the nature of our healthcare system in this country, which is profit-driven, you don't want to have too much supply, because you have too much supply that's going to cut into your profits. So you have a limited number of ICU beds, and you run out of beds. You run out of beds, and you have to make a decision. And you know, what we're hearing out of Utah is that they're getting ready to figure out what that algorithm is, or what that what that formula is. And it's basically younger people get the ICU beds. Older people who have less of a chance of living anyways through if they're that seriously ill with COVID, they get taken out of ICU. We could see this in parts of Texas. We could start seeing this part in parts of the Dakotas. And this is a function of not fighting the pandemic. You can offer all sorts of therapies you want and treatments, but if you don't have the room and the capacity to get people into the hospital, it's not going to make a difference. Here is Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, the president of the United States, basically saying, like, we're done with the whole try and control the pandemic thing. We'll just focus on, you know, what happens after you get sick.
Social groups and family groups. First, it was large groups. Now it's small groups.
It's
now
coming from all sorts of places.
Well, that's exactly
the point.
That's exactly
the
point.
Out of control.
So here's what we have to do. We're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigation.
Why aren't we going to get control of the pandemic?
Because it is a contagious virus, just like the flu.
Yeah, but why not make efforts to contain it?
Well, we are making efforts to contain it.
By running all over the country, not wearing a mask?
Jake,
that's what the vice president is doing.
We can get into the back and forth. Let me just say this, is what we need to do is make sure that we have the proper mitigation factors, whether it's therapies or vaccines or treatments, to make sure that people don't die from this. But to suggest that we're going to actually quarantine all of America,
No one's saying that.
Well, they are. Joe Biden's saying that. He says, lock everybody down. We're going to have a dark winter. We're going to have a dark
that's
winter.
That's what health officials say. That's what health officials say, that it's going to get worse.
No, we that's have Joe Biden's worst days. Jake, let's be honest.
Friday and Saturday.
The health officials did not say dark winter. Those were Joe Biden's words.
He was quoting William Hazeltine.
When we look at the number of cases increasing, what we have to do is make sure that we fight it with therapeutics and vaccines, take proper mitigation factors in terms of social distancing and masks when we can. And when we look at this, we're going to defeat it, Jake, because what we are, we're Americans. We do that. And this president is leading while Joe Biden is sitting there suggesting that we're going to mandate
masks. The president is holding rallies all over the country.
That's correct.
Masks required, no distancing. There have already been, according to health officials, contact tracing. There have already been cases of individuals in Minnesota and in Washington, D.C., and in Oklahoma that got the virus at these Trump rallies that Dr. Fauci himself called a super spreader event, the one
at
the White House.
There's also been contact tracing, Jake.
That is not leading.
There's also been contact tracing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know what else there is to say at this point. They are just going to say that, like, catch it, roll the dice, and if you're one of the lucky ones who don't have a bad effect, doesn't have a bad effect on you, then you're good. If you're one of the unlucky ones, we will treat you, but we have no plan for situations that are happening like in Utah, where there are so many people who are going into the ICU that some are going to have to be literally taken out of the ICU to make way for people who have a better chance of surviving. I mean, this is, and the idea, like, look, it is increasing all around the country, the world, where winter is upon them. You look in places like the Dakotas, you look in places like Utah, you look across Europe, you look at those temperatures, they're starting to get down to the 40s and the 50s. And we all heard when it hit in the early or late winter, early spring here, it's going to go away in the summer. It's going to get easier in the summer. Well, maybe it did. Maybe it did get easier in the summer. And we are now seeing day after day record number of infections, and maybe it's getting worse in the winter. And the real question is, like, what did we do with those 6 months where it was sort of ebbing, relatively speaking? Did we develop rapid testing? Did we develop a regime for contact tracing? Did we develop strategies for dealing with hotspots? I mean, maybe in some locales, but not in any national way. And they know they're at the end of this, so they just say, "Yeah, screw it. We're just not even gonna concentrate on it." Here he is. He tries to walk back. Meadows tries to clarify this morning on the statement, but in the course of saying it, he sort of indicates that no, actually, what I said was I'm almost double down on it. Listen to Mark Meadows today from the White House.
Well, the only person waving a white flag along with his white mask is Joe Biden. I mean, when we look at this, we're going to defeat the virus. We're not going to control it. We will try to contain it as best we can. And if you look at full context of what I was talking about is we need to make sure that we have therapeutics and vaccines. We need to make sure that when people get sick, that they have the kind of therapies that the President of the United States has that we can provide. Those emergency use authorizations hopefully will be coming in very short order.
I mean, he, in the midst of saying, no, we didn't wave the white flag, Joe Biden waved the white flag and his white mask. He literally mocks Joe Biden for doing exactly the one thing that every expert at this point says will mitigate the spread. The statistics run from 95% mask wearing in public would reduce the number of deaths by the end of the year by 100,000, by February by like 125,000. And he is out there claiming we're not giving up on controlling the spread of the pandemic, although I'm going to mock somebody now for doing the one thing that would have the greatest impact in controlling the spread of it. That's his answer. I mean, just even the compulsion of, like, I mean, why? I don't even understand what is the mentality. What do they think they're getting out of this? That there's a lot of people out there, I guess they're just trying to rally all the people who are like, well, we're not going to mitigate this. And I am voting for the president who has come out and forcefully said, we're not going to try and control this pandemic. That's the president I've been looking for. The one who's going to not just not control the pandemic, but make it a point of pride. Pretty shocking stuff. Meanwhile, a couple of messages from our sponsors today. I don't even know why ZipRecruiter sends us any copy, because we have the best ZipRecruiter story that you could possibly have. ZipRecruiter, of course, is a hiring service that helps you find candidates for your job. And right now, all of our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, what it does is it sends it out to over 100 job sites with just one click. And then ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job, actively invites them to apply, so you get qualified candidates fast. It's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I am one of those 5. Wait, no, I'm one of the 4. Well, I guess I'm one of the 4 and one of the 5, because I'm 4 out of 5. And we found Brendan through ZipRecruiter. I had maybe 10 great interviews, but Brendan was hit it out of the park. And we would not have had Brendan but for ZipRecruiter, and basically because ZipRecruiter went out and grabbed him, saw his activity on job sites, posting stuff, and said, you should apply to this, because everything you're talking about and the job experience you've had and what you're looking for matches. And boom, it was nuts. Brendan walked in, honestly, if I was like to create him in a laboratory, in terms of his skill sets, it would have been Brendan. That's probably the nicest thing I've ever said about you, Brendan.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. MAJORITY. You might be stressed out about the election, but you won't be stressed out about hiring when you try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Folks who have listened to this show or watched the show for an extended period of time know that I am sartorially challenged. I don't like to shop. I don't have the greatest sense of style. I'm trying to get a little better. That's why I let Stitch Fix do most of my hard work when it comes to shopping. Stitch Fix offers clothing that's hand-selected by expert stylists for my unique size and your unique size, style, and budget. It's a completely different and fun way to find clothes that you're going to love to wear. What you do is you try on that they send you, you pick them out, or you get a stylist who basically gives you an idea of types of clothes based upon your selections and the types of clothes you've been wearing. I send it to you. You try it on. You keep what you like. You put what you don't like back in their box. It's super easy to send it back. You pay a $20 styling fee for each box, and that gets credited toward any piece that you keep. You don't have to have a subscription. You can try Stitch Fix once, or you can set it up for automatic deliveries. Plus, shipping, returns, and exchanges are easy and free, and a prepaid return envelope is included. It's super easy to do this. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing. They have it for women. They have it for men. They have it for kids. They ship all over the U.S. and is available in the U.K. too. I've talked about the leather chukas or chukas that I got. I don't know what they're called. They're penguin chukas. Brendan always has to fix my pronunciation on that. And I got a pair of 5-pocket flag and anthem pants, which is the first time I've gone back into that whole sort of like almost like jean cut pants. And I'm actually thinking about going full in on jeans. I haven't worn jeans in years. And I got a mock like turtleneck thing that I sent back. I'm not a mock turtleneck guy, but Mila took my flannel. And I got this Pilsen Thermal Crew, which I was like, I don't know. This is sort of going back in time for me, because back in my slacker days, it was always a Thermal Crew. And then, of course, it's winter now. And so I got back on it. And now I think I'm going to head over there and get my winter fix. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. All right, quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alex Salmon, the staff writer at American Prospect, about how Uber and Lyft are buying labor laws. We are back on the phone, or I guess on the computer. Alex Salmon, staff writer at the American Prospect, on his piece, How Uber and Lyft Are Buying Labor Laws. Alex, thanks for joining us. This is, and I think when you wrote this piece 2 weeks ago, you had said that this was the largest, the most costly ballot proposition in the history of the country. And I just saw on Twitter, it's being reported by Sam Harnett, reporting on labor and techno-capitalism for KQED, that these gig companies put another $9 million into the yes on Proposition 2. That is $199,433. It's almost $200 million. I can't even do the numbers here. I'm sorry. That's extraordinary.
An astonishing amount of money. I mean, it's really like nothing we've ever seen. And the deficit on the other side is something to behold as well. So no on 22 has, with a kind of last second push here, now has $19 million to its name. So it's a 10 to 1 advantage for yes on 22. And it's some money we've never seen on a ballot level, you know, proposition level, ballot initiative like that. It's astonishing.
Who are the companies that are spending this $200 million? I mean, do we know exactly, or do we have a broad understanding?
Yeah, we know exactly. It's Uber, it's Lyft, it's DoorDash, it's Postmates, it's Grubhub. And there may be another one in there, that I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's that class of food delivery and ride sharing startup, that are six or seven that basically offer the same service, and they make up the overwhelming majority of that money that they've each individually put up.
So this is like the, I'm sorry, we lost you there for a moment. This is the full on gig economy cohort, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would they do that, Alex? I mean, that's a lot of money to spend on an election. Tell us what Proposition 22 is.
Sure. So Proposition 22 is a pretty substantial tweak to labor law at a very basic level. And so right now we have two different classes of workers in this economy. We have employees and we have independent contractors. And Prop 22 would create a third class, which is food delivery and ride sharing workers. So those are people who are neither independent contractors nor employees. And it comes out of a law passed in California last year called AB 5, which decided that, basically clarified that workers, drivers for Uber and Lyft, et cetera, are in fact not independent contractors. They're misclassified as such. And that was based on a state Supreme Court ruling from the year before. So basically this law or Proposition 22 creates a separate category just for the workforce of these companies that would allow them to continue to circumvent minimum wage standards, worker protections, and various other things that every other company is held to in this state.
All right. So this is a carve out from the law. Can we be a little more specific in terms of like what it is that allows them to do and what it is that EB-5, you know, required in terms of that classification? Because if I'm a contractor, versus a paid employee? What's the criteria? I mean, I know there's a little bit of a gray area, a little bit, but what is the criteria there? And that gray area has been exploited. What is the criteria for a paid employee as opposed to a paid contractor?
Right. So there's a three-pronged test, and this was what was established in this Supreme Court decision 2 years ago, California Supreme Court decision, known as Dynamex. And there are these three prongs. And the first prong is that a worker is free to perform services without the control or direction of the company. The second is that the worker is performing tasks that are outside the usual course of a company's business. And the third is that a worker is engaged in an independently established trade. So those are all, that's legalese, right? But you can, even in that definition, you can see that someone who's, you know, driving for Uber or Lyft, someone who's, you know, doing ride sharing is not engaged in it, in an activity that's outside of the normal course of business of Uber or Lyft. And so if you hit on any of those three things, you are an employee, not a contractor. And for an employee of a company like Uber or Lyft, that means that they need to pay minimum wage. That means they need to pay into unemployment insurance. They need to pay payroll tax. They need to do these simple things that companies do to operate in this economy. And the idea of doing that was anathema to these companies that already lose a ton of money. And adding obligations to payroll and such like that was just a non-starter for them. So they basically have been engaged in sort of a multi-year end run around this ruling that has kind of led to this final solution where they realize they've run out of room to make the case that these are independent contractors. So now they're making a separate case that actually they're a third made up class of worker that will conveniently allow them to not have to pay them as employees, not have to pay minimum wage, not have to give them basic protections and benefits.
I mean, it's a hard argument to make if you're Uber that people driving cars is outside of the normal course of our business. I mean, that seems like a really difficult, and I guess their argument was like, we're just a platform that a technological platform that just happens, just by happen chance, one of the things we do is hook up people with drivers of cars. The problem for their argument is that's all they do. And I guess maybe they also say like, well, we also hook up people with driver cars who deliver food, which is also exactly what they're doing. I mean, so it's absurd. Why is this important to an average worker? Because I mean, I think you do a great job in the piece, at least one of them that I've read, connecting the implications of this to not just somebody who's driving a car for Uber in California. I mean, this is not just an end run around California state laws, but like a lot of things, what starts in California ends up moving across the country. What are the implications materially for workers, specifically for Uber at this point, but then we can broaden it out, when you are classified as an employee as opposed to this new classification? You're like an employee, but we're going to give you the rights of a contractor.
Right. So it's precedent setting in a lot of ways. And that's why it's a huge concern, I think, for anyone who works in basically any industry. If you're a teacher, if you're a truck driver, I mean, there's almost no sector that would be immune to this sort of thinking or reorganization if this passes. And so at a material level, the most concerning sort of immediate thing is that the research coming out of Berkeley has shown that if this passes, so part of what they're selling this on is that, well, they're going to pay drivers 120% of local minimum wage for the time that they're working. And that's one of the suite of essential benefits that they're offering. But the actual math, as you do it, turns out to show that workers would make $5.64 an hour driving for Uber, Lyft, et cetera, under the situation that would be enshrined by Prop 22. And so they're not paid for the time they're waiting. They're not paid for the time that they're, you know, anything except for the active time they're driving, which is not the majority of the work that they're doing. And so, again, you have this carve out where they're not going to be given minimum wage. They're not going to be given these essential and very basic protections. And if Uber and Lyft can do this, then why can't any other sector? And so it becomes one of these things where, all right, well, why don't we put nurses on this standard? Like, let's only pay nurses while they're actually actively in the room giving care, and any other point in their workday, we're going to keep them uncompensated. Or teachers, you know, everyone basically becomes a substitute teacher. And these sorts of things are extremely destabilizing for workers, because you don't know how much money you're taking home at the end of the day at a very basic level. And that's something, having a steady wage floor is one of the most important things for a person in this society. You have to know how much money you're going to make. And these standards basically set up a whole new regime of employment and labor that is far more precarious than anything we've seen. And something that, you know, to borrow a Silicon Valley term, is certainly scales, and it scales all over the country. It can scale all over the world. And it would not be difficult for them to implement. And that's, I think, why this is such a alarming proposition and why there's so much money behind it.
So we have it's a way of skirting minimum wage requirements, because like you say, that study, I think that came out of UC Berkeley Labor Center, that they, these folks are waiting up to like 37% of the time they are waiting, which makes sense, right? I mean, now, I would also imagine that if something like this gets passed, who's to say that Uber and Lyft don't hire quasi-contract other drivers, and that waiting time can go up, right? I mean, because the service that they pretend they're not offering gets better if, you know, you have more drivers out there, because people are waiting, their wait time for the driver is less because you got drivers waiting all over the place. And so their hourly rates can only go down in that respect. And then they're not subject to things like you said, to things like Social Security deductions, and there's no sort of retirement built for them. And that's a cost to society, right? Because at the end of their lives, if they don't have retirement savings, because they've been making, you know, as low as $5.64 an hour driving an Uber, or they don't have Social Security, well, somebody's going to have to pay for them to stay out of poverty in some fashion or another. And that's going to be either their kids or incumbent upon society. So it's going to be a drain on society. Let me ask you this. They're claiming they're going to be even less more unprofitable if they're required to pay workers. And as a small business person, I understand this dynamic. If I didn't have to pay anybody to work for me, I would be making more money. That doesn't seem like a good argument for why I shouldn't have to pay people. Let's start with this. Why are they so unprofitable now? Like, how is this a business if they can't make money at it? Even exploiting workers?
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. And the way that it's even posited, I think, is fascinating, that, you know, in some sense, the defense of these companies is, well, they have a right to exist, like they should exist. But it's also like, by what standard should they exist? I mean, right, like what company has been able to lose money as prodigiously as these ride sharing startups? I mean, the burn rate on cash is like something we've never seen. It's this conspiracy of historical forces where you have so much venture capital money coming from the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, going into a company that has never turned a profit and that seems endlessly capable of losing money in new and diverse ways. And the idea that like an increase in the cost of payroll or the tax obligations that they would owe to the state for unemployment insurance, which I think is an important component of this, it's not even that significant compared to how much money they burn on a regular basis just through their operation. And so it's a great question. It's like, okay, well, why should a company like this get special treatment? Like, what, just because it loses a lot of money, just is it exempt from the standards that we hold every other company to? And that's a twist, I think, on like market logic that we haven't seen so far. It's a very strange one, and it's kind of amusing. But it's also extremely dark because it turns out that the financial backing that they have is functionally infinite because they don't have enough money to pay wages, but they do have enough money to throw $200 million into just one ballot measure. And it's not even clear if it'll succeed. So it's you know, again, it's a question of power and priority and structuring of the economy in as much as it is of simple profit. And I think that's important to remember.
Okay, so I mean, we've got two separate issues here. It seems to me. I mean, one is like you have these companies that are unprofitable as they are, and and maybe that's a function of like they're just dumping all this money into marketing. And they're dumping a ton of money into lobbying that, you know, you could put putting $200 million into a ballot measure in one state as part of that lobbying. But they have a huge amount of money. They spent a tremendous amount of money on just hiring former Obama officials over the years so that they can manipulate the laws. I mean, that's basically what's going on here, right? Is that fundamentally they're saying we have this idea for a business. And for us to make the kind of profits that we need to make, because again, like there's no way that you couldn't set up, let's say, a co-op in some fashion. I mean, you know, and do this at a very low profit margin, I guess, but they have gotten all sorts of tech investment that are anticipating 10x, 100x returns. So their profitability has to be much bigger in the future for their entire business plan to work. And they are basically saying, and I think to a certain extent, all businesses do this, like, we want you to subsidize our profits. Like, you know, we like, and the way we see it with chemical companies is, roll back your protections on how clean your air has to be, or how clean your air has to be, your water has to be, so that we can dump stuff into your rivers and it'll be cheaper for us and we'll make more profits. We're seeing that same dynamic, but we're seeing it play out now in this just random business of a supposed tech platform that needs people to drive. Like, if their business was just coming up with the tech, it seems to me, which is what their argument, then they should be profitable, right? Like it's like they get a markup on the rides and that's it. But they're spending a lot of money to undercut our labor laws, our municipal you know, statutes that protect drivers and consumers. And they want us to pay for it. And so like, give us a sense of if they're successful at this, at creating this carve out that is just basically like, we're such a vital, I mean, it's almost like some type of national security argument, right? Like, we're so vital to the functioning of society that we deserve special rights to impoverish huge swaths of people. Who else could adopt this? Like, who couldn't adopt this philosophy, I guess, and this attempt at some other state to roll back laws or to do it on a federal level?
Yeah, I think it's important to think about exactly where this money is coming from. And with, you know, venture capital money, with private equity money, why would they not, if you're a private equity firm, why would you not go buy a nursing home, go buy a bunch of nursing homes and then say, all right, well, this worked for our essential service of food delivery. Why not? Well, let's try it out with the essential service of caregiving or nursing. And so, you know, we own all these facilities and we have to pay these nurses, I don't know, $12 an hour, but we could pay them $5 an hour in the aggregate and just pay them for the time they're, you know, in the room. And that would cut down our costs considerably. Well, why would you not give that a try? I mean, if it only costs you $200 million to do it, I mean, you know, at a certain point, we're talking about money that's actually not that significant compared to the profit take that a lot of these big financial institutions would win out of this. And so, why not try that on nursing homes? Let's try it out on schools. I mean, teachers only teach, you know, how many hours a day. So let's get them on a system where they're only getting paid for the active time in the classroom. And a lot of that, I mean, you know, we've already seen to some degree in some of these parts of the economy, but it would be something that would formalize that and make it such that you could basically export this anywhere. And given that these extremely deep pocketed groups, you know, venture capital groups have the ability to enter sectors of the economy with that much power, the ability to export this labor model, you know, could go a lot of different places, and it certainly would. I mean, there's just no reason it wouldn't. If that's if that's the cost for you to get in there in the door is $200 million. You split it six ways. It's how could you not? I mean, the incentive is so clear there. And I think that's, very important to think about going forward.
And just like, I want to just touch a little bit too on what they're doing electorally. I got a text this morning from a friend of mine in California who said, hey, you should let people know on your show that Uber and Lyft are giving 50% off rides to the polls. And I was like, oh, that's both a nice gesture and also a great way to get their people to the polls. You have a captured audience. You write in here that every time a driver signs on to his Uber shift, he's got to commit to what, to supporting the Proposition 22. That's just stunning to me. And I presumably in the car and when you get your app, you know, there's a vote yes on Prop 22 thing or something like that. They're doing that on one hand, and it's obviously a captured audience, and it's their people, right? Like, they don't have to go out and say, we only want Uber and Lyft users to go to the polls. Well, they're just going to drive them all there. And then you have organization heads, right? Because many of the drivers you write of Uber and Lyft and these sort of gig economies are people of color. And obviously, many in situations, some of those people also across the board are low income folks. And you've got organizations out there who are, many are against, but some are for. You write that the NAACP California president, Alice Huffman, is a supporter of Yes on 22. And she is, she has some conflicts here, doesn't she?
That's right. Yeah. It's, I mean, this kind of gets to the, I guess this is what $200 million buys you in an election this small, but the cynicism, I think, in the messaging is maybe the kind of most mind blowing part of this whole thing. And that exactly as you said, that the majority of drivers are people of color and immigrants. I mean, that's just a fact of the workforce. And yet you see groups like the NAACP and NAN, which is Al Sharpton's group, and, I think Si Se Puede, which is another like Latino political group, coming out in support of Yes on 22, which in a very clear way would wipe out the earnings of people that they claim to represent. And in the case of Alice Huffman, who's the president of the California NAACP, she has an arrangement where she has a private consulting firm called AC Public Affairs, and Yes on 22 has contracted her as a consultant and made an $85,000 payment to her, consulting firm. And she turned around and has, you know, supported Yes on 22 personally. The NAACP of California has supported Yes on 22. And nowhere will you see that obvious financial incentive, disclosed. They made a lot on minorities.
You're breaking up a little bit there, but I think, you know, I don't know how much $85,000 buys. And, you know, there are times where I guess you could say like, well, I'm already in favor of this, so I'm a good candidate to go and work for them. But it seems like a little bit of a conflict of interest to me. I mean, it's one thing to support something if you're the head of an organization. It's another to monetize that support. At the very least, you gotta make it clear that you're getting paid for it as well, and that you could say it's, and that's just a coincidence. Just the one thing that I think is the case that I know, at least in the context of New York, friends that I have who are Black have said that, you know, for years. And I think it's fairly well known, very difficult for Black people in particular to get rides by taxis back in the day where there was no Uber or Lyft or any of these ride, share things. Is there a way that these companies or these services, so I don't really care which company it is, if it's Uber or Lyft, I used to use Juno, that went away. Is there any way for these companies to survive without having to immiserate their workers in this way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's funny that we, engage with them on their own terms. But I think on a municipal level, you could have something like Uber and Lyft be extremely successful, be fairly civic minded, and also pay a reasonable wage for the people who do it. So, you know, if you had a, if you even just set up a system where you said, all right, if Uber and Lyft are going to operate in our city, they need to give us access to the platform, and we're going to furnish basically a parallel program where we're going to have drivers who work for the city and people pay to use it. And then, you know, we pay a minimum wage and we profit share off of the amount of money that comes in over that at the end of the month. I mean, it's not an expensive operation to run. It does serve a basic purpose, which is getting people around. And it could be oriented in a wildly different way to benefit a lot of people. And so, yeah, I mean, there are so many different ways to imagine this service being done for a public good, for a public interest, in a way that doesn't impoverish the people who do it. And we're not that far away from doing that. I mean, it's something that is entirely conceivable. And so to be held hostage by these companies and to even to concede that they're doing something on, you know, out of some sort of racial justice motivation is just, it's totally absurd. And there is a world in which we can have ride sharing, or we can have this sort of transportation system that works for someone other than a handful of investors in Silicon Valley. I mean, it doesn't take a ton of imagination to get there.
Right. This is a fight, not necessarily for Uber or Lyft or those type of enterprises to survive, as much as it is a right for them to survive, making enormous 10x, 100x profits on their investments long term. Alex Salmon, from the American Prospect, people can find your piece, How Uber and Lyft Are Buying Labor Laws, in the American Prospect. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sam.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in a moment. I want to give you an update on the story coming out of Chile. We are back, Sam Steeder on the Majority Report. I don't know how familiar people are with the history of Chile. I guess this is because of my age a little bit. The story of Chile was fairly formative in my perception of what America's role has been in our hemisphere, at least. And in 1973, the country of Chile was, the president of Chile was Salvador Allende. He was a socialist, and there were American interests that, American corporate interests that, I guess, people in this country felt were in some way, threatened by Allende. And by threatened, I mean, like, you know, their profits, their money was in some way threatened. And America was involved, the CIA involved in a military coup that took place in Chile on September 11th, 1973. It led to the death of Allende. And Chile was then ruled essentially by a military junta. Augusto Pinochet was I don't know if you would call him the president. He was the head of that. That rule ended some time ago, but what remained in its wake was a constitution that was written in 1980. Now, one of the, during the Pinochet era, one of the people famous for going down there and advising Pinochet on how to reconstruct his economy was a group of advisors from the University of Chicago, often known as the Chicago Boys, they were libertarians with a neoliberal philosophy, Milton Friedman chief among them, and they helped them develop a constitution based upon these sort of neoliberal, libertarian, these words get thrown around, but it's basically saying the privatization, market over people, give corporations the power, and their motive for profit will bring about better social outcomes. What we're seeing with these gig economy companies pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into a ballot initiative to essentially rewrite our labor laws that have existed in this country in some fashion or another for 80, 90 years, some instances more, that this is a neo, this is a, the ultimate neoliberal project, right? Where it's, we're going to make it as if this is, we're just allowing natural economic forces to dictate, when in fact, what we're doing is we're influencing the laws to function in a way that ultimately benefit us at the cost of society and specific workers. And so this constitution has been in effect in Chile for about 40 years. And it called for all sorts of changes to Chile society, privatizing education, privatizing health, privatizing pensions, et cetera, et cetera. And
legislative supermajorities needed for a lot of these things.
Oh, yes. We should also say, speaking of which didn't come up in the conversation with Alex, that Proposition 22, to reverse Proposition 22, you need 7/8, I think it is, of the California legislature to vote against it, to shoot it down. 7/8, a virtually impossible threshold to cover. And enshrining these things, they did it in Chile. In fact, in California, when they had some type of tax revolt there, they did a similar thing. You need a supermajority to raise taxes. What? Why? And same in Chile, which leads to, obviously, you can have the majority of people, even a significant majority of the people, say, we want less austerity. We want more public services. We want health or education, or we want these, or energy infrastructure. We want these things to work for the benefit of people first. We don't want these things to work for the benefit of profits first. And their system was set up in such a way that even if the majority of people want that, we're going to prevent it, because we got in at a time during a military coup, set up the rules of the game to make it impervious to that type of democracy. I mean, let's be honest. We're seeing an iteration, a version of that with the Republicans. They sit in a Senate where the majority of Americans have voted for their opponent, the Democrats. And yet today they're going to enshrine their entire philosophy by putting Amy Coney Barrett on the court. And you see it in states like Wisconsin, where you have Democrats win 56% of the vote, yet Republicans control 65% of the House and the Senate in Wisconsin. And there's several other states very similar to that. So highly anti-democratic, highly ademocratic, if you will, and also policies that reflect that. Well, the Chilean people have rejected, or I should say have voted, to approve a rewrite, 78.24% to 21.76%. And they also called for a committee or commission to rewrite this that involves none of the sitting lawmakers that exist today. And it's a completely separate, popularly elected body. And by no means are they out of the woods. It's going to be a two-year process. In April, they'll elect 155 members, equal numbers, men and women. This is going to be the world's first constitution drafted by a group that has gender parity. They will draft it over the course of 9 months. There'll be an option for a three-month extension. And then voters must decide whether they accept the a new charter in a referendum in 2022. And the draft need only be approved by a majority, as the way it should be. Very heartening story in Chile, and it's one that we should pay attention to. And it's one that, who knows, may be an inspiration to people in this country as we deal with a lot of anti-democratic policies and functioning of our government that's going to be a function of a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court going forward. We'll have more to talk about tomorrow. We will see you then. And for those of you who are sticking around for the rest of the program, we've got a lot to talk about with you as well. We've got all sorts of house cleaning to do. We're going to have a announcement. We've got someone new joining the show. I will announce that over the next, I think in a day or two, and they'll show up in a little bit less than a week, maybe for our election coverage going forward. More on that later. But I thought I would just throw a tease in there. We are gearing up with the hopes of having a Biden administration and all the fights that are going to be associated with that. There are attempts right now to get Elizabeth Warren as Treasury Secretary. There are attempts, as reported by Politico anyways, that Bernie Sanders has interest in being Labor Secretary. It's a sort of fascinating development. There is a, and we will talk more about this going forward, but in Vermont anyways, the governor of Vermont, what's his name? Scott? It's his last name. Can't remember. The governor of Vermont has, Phil Scott, has committed, he's a Republican, but he has committed to replacing Bernie Sanders if Sanders is asked to join the administration with a with an independent who caucuses with the Democrats. So net, you don't lose a vote there. I have not heard any such commitment from Charlie Barker, Baker in Massachusetts regarding Elizabeth Warren's seat. Now, this is relevant depending on what the outcome of the Senate races are. If you have And frankly, Joe Biden's stomach to get rid of the filibuster. We should talk more about this. And maybe this would be a good segment to have over the coming days where we bring somebody on who's dug into this. But essentially, this is the dynamic that's going on. And so with all that said, you know, and I think I said this in the run-up to 2016. It's just that I didn't, you know, I had... The idea of something that has a 15% chance of happening, we just don't generally rely on, right? If I say that there's a 15% chance of it raining today, you probably won't take an umbrella. If I tell you there's a 50% chance, you probably start getting into the realm of maybe, yeah, I will. 60, 70% chance, you're taking an umbrella, unless you like to get wet. 2016, there was a 15% chance, I think it was, by most polling things. I had somebody on who said there was a 99% chance of Hillary Clinton winning. But I think there is a 15% chance, 20% chance of Donald Trump winning. And I don't know, flip a coin. Do it five times. But that's not the way it works, right? That's 50-50, right? With a coin, and you got to do it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
What is it that you, what is there a type of coin? You need like
a dice might get you close.
Exactly. Right. How many are there? Six sides on a die. Yeah. That's pretty close. Maybe that's closer to like, what, 16%, 17% chance of a specific number? But do it that way. Well, it's craps, right? I mean, it's basically craps, I guess, on some level. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the odds are.
So I'm going to win. Okay.
I'm looking forward to a situation where we are fighting on terrain that is not between, you know, is not where one of the margins is not like full on fascism. That's a much better terrain to be fighting on. Just a reminder, excuse me. Your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that keeps this show going. And when you give us your support, we give you extra content every day. We give you the free show, free of commercials. And we give you a warm, cuddly feeling. So, I mean, that's not guaranteed, the cuddly feeling part. But we try. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Oh, and listen, if you are interested in the fun half, but you do not have the resources, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But best to wait till after the election, because we'll have more time then, and your email will not get lost. We are woefully behind on a lot of these. Sadly, and my apologies for that, but we will get on it. Don't forget 3 p.m. every day except for Monday, the Nomi Key Show. You can find at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. We've got it now, that GNOME. I don't know why that makes it easier for me, but it does. Where's Jamie? Is she around?
She's not in here yet. But
all right. Well, Matt, why don't you tell us about TMBS tomorrow?
Yeah, full slate tomorrow. We have two shorter interviews with Eric Osgood and Ryan Pollack. But Megan Day will be the headliner, talking about rural America and healthcare, and also What Is After Bernie. That's tonight, or tomorrow night, I should say, at the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel at patreon.com/TMBS. And also, I will probably be streaming something, I'm not sure what, at twitch.tv/literary hangover tonight. So subscribe to that, Twitch folks.
I wanted to hit something that was a little bit more intriguing, but that's the first thing.
That's a very old-fashioned sound effect.
It is.
That's like from like when my parents were watching TV.
That's exactly. And that's the it's that thing on the horn they got there. That little cap on it. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Hey, so this week on the Antifada, we had on Pavlos Rufos, a great author and political economist, originally from Greece. He's currently studying for his PhD in Berlin. We spoke to him. We got a little update on how austerity is going for Greece. Spoiler alert, not well, as well as what's going on with the Golden Dawn. How big a defeat for the far right is this in Greece and for the world? The ways the economic crisis lead to right-wing radicalism, and a little bit we talk about COVID because that's on everybody's mind right now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also on Friday, we released a bonus where we had a little fun with a review of Shrek 2 written by an obscure Maoist sect. And that's out now as well. And look for a spooky Halloween episode coming out on Wednesday.
Wait, what? Shrek 2 was written by a Maoist sect?
A review of Shrek 2 written by the Maoist International Movement. And it's actually an interesting capsule of not just what Maoists think about Shrek 2, but the Bush years in particular, because they talk a lot about the Iraq War in this review.
I have not seen Shrek 2, but now I'm intrigued. But I don't know. I watched Beethoven 1 and 2 this weekend, and I will tell you, that movie does not hold up. So I don't think I saw it the first time around, but it was not. I was almost impressed by how not good it was. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I am also turning on our IM to see all of you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. Africans. The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on! Fuck em, fuck em, fuck em. Fuck em, fuck em, fuck em.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back. Black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.